Thanks to the more than 1,000 listeners who donated to our end of fiscal year campaign. If you've not yet donated, consider making a contribution of $8.50 a month. We'll say thanks by sending you a Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins mug. Learn more and donate at 704-549-9000 or online at WFAE.org. And thanks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We are 21 days into hurricane season. It follows one of the worst on record, and already there has been damage and loss of life in the Carolinas because of rain from Hurricane Alberto. We look at what the rest of this season may have in store later in the program. First, trouble at the airport. Beginning last Thursday and through much of this week, American Airlines' wholly owned subsidiary PSA, which flies smaller planes on regional routes, had troubles with their computer system, resulting in the cancellation of 2,700 flights around the country, 2,000 at Charlotte Douglas alone. That meant hundreds of frustrated, stranded passengers.
Unreal, aggravating, and there's nothing we can do.
Every hour, every time we think we're getting out of here, we got canceled.
There's no Uber, there's no Lyft.
We're tired, we're ready to go home.
Very annoyed and angry with American. I'm probably never going to try flying that way again.
They would be one thing if these computer glitches were unusual, but they aren't. They seem to be happening with more frequency and with the same passenger experiences. They've also cost airlines tens of millions of dollars. So why is this happening? What is being done to fix the problem? Why have the friendly skies become so unfriendly? And how much longer can airlines get away with all this? Seth Kaplan may have some thoughts on this. He's the managing partner at Airline Weekly. That's a subscriber-supported publication paid for by readers about developments in the airline industry. And he joins us via Skype this morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning. Also with us on Skype is Charlie Leoka. He's president of Travelers United, which describes itself as the only nonprofit representing all travelers before Congress and with travel regulators. Thank you for joining us, too.
Hey, good to be here.
Thanks. Seth, briefly, tell us what happened with American and their subsidiary regional carrier PSA that caused all this mess over the last week.
Yeah, and that's what this is. It's a wholly owned regional subsidiary. When you get on those smaller planes, very often carried by, can be a separate company contracted out, or in this case, an airline owned by American but called PSA with some different systems. And they have their what are called departure control systems that take care of filing flight plans, let's say, for pilots. Just reconciling all the passenger information. And all of a sudden, it wasn't working late last week. They got the system back up, at least they thought they did. And then it started running very, very slowly, had what computer people call latency issues. Imagine being on your computer, you do something that should take seconds, and instead it takes hours. Mm-hmm. That's what was happening to all of these flights. And so I'll be honest, we were editing our newsletter. It goes out Sunday night, and we had been writing about it in the past tense, like this happened last week, and all of a sudden it all started again, and we're like, wait a minute, this is an ongoing thing. How long is it going to go on? And as you mentioned, into early this week with close to 3,000 flights canceled.
So they're not the only airline that's had this problem with scheduling problems, and this was a problem with scheduling crews with various aircraft. It wasn't necessarily with passengers being able to be scheduled to be booked, but these various airlines have had this problem over the last 3, 4, 5 years. Why? If a system is humming along and it's working, we've all had these problems with our own personal computers. You reboot and everything's back. So why do these problems seem to be so pervasive and critical when they happen, and so difficult to get back up and running?
Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with, if you were just setting up an airline today, a clean sheet project, you would do it in a different way than these airlines are set up, right? You'd often have new systems interacting with very old legacy systems that date back decades. And so, just all of the regulatory safety issues that they have to deal with. So it is more complicated than our computers, but you're right, this shouldn't happen. And, generally speaking, as you mentioned, these things seem to happen and do happen more frequently now. On one hand, when you kind of look at the headline operational statistics of these airlines, on a day-to-day basis, they tend to actually be more reliable than they used to be, thanks partly to automation, right? I mean, the computers do some good things. That's why they're there. But then when things go wrong, they go really wrong. And you know, decades ago, you couldn't have had one glitch that would have caused something like this.
To put numbers to this, a Crane's Chicago Business reports that there were 17 incidents of technology glitches snarling U.S. airlines in 2016, 16 the year before. Do we know, Charlie, how many we've experienced last year or even so far this year that have caused any significant or noticeable problem?
Well, I think that we're probably in the same range that we were in the past, in the previous couple of years. What's happening is that these IT systems right now, information technology systems for the airlines, are getting so big and so complex that if something goes wrong, it's hard to figure it out. You know, you ask the simple question, gee, what went wrong? If they had a simple answer, they'd be able to fix it in a heartbeat, but they can't. And meanwhile, what ends up happening is that consumers are the people who bear the brunt of this. Yes, the airlines are losing tens of millions of dollars, but that's on operational sides. But the consumers are missing out on vacations, they're missing out on weddings, they're missing out on all sorts of areas that they cannot get back. It's more than money. And so there's absolutely no consequences for the airlines other than what they lose operationally.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because you're a traveler's advocate. What are the airlines on the hook for if passengers are stranded for the weekend? Do they have to pay for your meals? Do they have to put you up in a hotel? Do they have to pay for a rental car if it's feasible for you to drive to your destination? What are they liable for?
Well, basically, they're liable for nothing. It's the way that they've written all of their contracts of carriage and the way that the DOT rules and regulations are written. They basically can say, gee, we're really sorry, and you're on your own. And I've had people come over and knock on my door, friends of mine, say, hey, Charlie, they just threw me out into the street. There was a problem at the airport. They're not taking off, and I'm stuck. Okay, well, come on in. I've got a couch. But that's the problem, is that if I wanted to cancel my flight, the airlines ding us an amazing amount, $200, just to cancel a flight, even if you only paid $75 for it. Right. Or if you were doing an international flight, it's $300. But yet, if they cancel a flight, nothing. Zero, nada. It's just tough. And so this is a problem that we're running into. And we've been talking to DOT now for years about this. And we've tried to get it into the different FAA bills. However, we're in a situation where all we can really do is talk with these people. We don't have the money that we need to really put people on the ground and to get the attention of the senators and congressmen.
Airlines say that IT problems cause less than 1% of delays, far less trouble than that is caused by either weather or traffic control issues. You can't control the weather. You can control, one would think, your computer system. So, Seth, given that these incidents can cost in the high millions of dollars per incident, why aren't airlines scrambling to upgrade their IT to the most modern systems available?
Yeah, and you would hope that just the cost to them, as you mentioned, and the worst of these can run upwards of $100 million. I remember there was one Delta a year or so back. There were days of basically a global, what's called a ground stop. Nothing was happening. So you would hope that that would be enough of an incentive, you know, that you wouldn't need something else. And I guess that's the question, right? Is something else necessary, because they are continuing to go on. I mean, a lot of it has to do with, as I mentioned before, the interconnectivity. You know, when you get on a flight, that airline has to have systems that can talk with just the most antiquated system anywhere in the world from some other airline that's connecting onto them. And so it's always sort of this patchwork of many different systems. And that's why they can't just say, in the same way that, you know, a consumer can say, hey, I'm just getting rid of this old computer and starting fresh. Now, that's no consolation to all those tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are impacted by this outage and the millions who have been impacted by other outages. But that's why it's just not that simple.
You know, we no longer talk to reservation agents to book a flight. We book flights on our computers or on the app on our phone. We no longer talk to gate agents. We have our boarding passes on our phone, or we can print them out at home before we even get to the airport. That technology all seems to work pretty well, and it's all brand new technology, relatively recent technology. Why doesn't the technology that schedules the planes and the flight crews work as flawlessly?
I
just think that, you know, one of the problems that we've got is the reservation systems and the passenger facing systems have been basically run by a group of large IT operators called Sabre. It started by American Airlines, and then there's Amadeus, which is cobbled together from a number of other airline reservation systems. And those systems have been working, and they're still using mainframe computers. And they don't really have a lot of the high-tech systems in place for privacy and so on, but they work, and they allow the global airline system to communicate with each other. These days, there's a giant battle between the legacy systems, such as we call them the GDSs, or the global distribution systems, and the airlines. The airlines are trying to bring in more and more of the IT into their own control. And this is what has gone wrong, is that the IT systems put together by the airlines just breaks down every so often. The other systems have more of a backup, and we seem to get better passenger service there. But the airlines are having problems getting their pilots to the right place and their crews in the right area and their planes scheduled. And that is really creating a major problem.
I would say also, Mike, that these outages, it's always some weird one-off thing that, and you can be sure that thing is never going to happen again. And yet you can be just as sure that some other thing is going to happen. And so, they solve that problem. But then it's kind of like that old, whack-a-mole game at the arcade where, once you hit one, something else ends up popping up.
Well, how much of this is actually due to the fact that they have all these legacy systems paired with all these new systems? Some of these systems run by the airlines. Some of these systems run by that consortium of airlines that you mentioned, Sabre and others. And the fact that they have added to that now all these consumer overlays for apps on your phone to check your flight status, to book your flight, to change your flight, to pick your seat, to talk about your dietary requirements for the in-flight meal, to book your baggage. All of this comes on your smartphone. How much of that has just bogged down this incredibly, because you're now talking about hundreds of millions of passengers.
You really are, Mike. And part of the problem is that all of the airlines want to what they call own their passenger. They're loath to give any of the information away to anybody else. This is another thing that we in Washington have been, Travelers United has been working at now since 2009, and that's a simple thing called transparency. We want to know how much it costs to actually fly. And the system is so complex that as I'm speaking to you, there is no shopping engine that can take into account the entire system that the airlines have built right now. And they don't care. They would much rather cobble it up and work on just seat reservations here and paying fees there and an app over there instead of having a unified system which allows all travelers to know how much the total cost of travel is going to be. And that same problem also comes home to roost when they're talking about airline scheduling, airplane scheduling, crew scheduling, and so on. And so it becomes a real problem for consumers, and it's caused by, I hate to say, but it comes down to airline greed in the end. They're trying to do it all themselves and keep all the money and not share it among the distribution system, and now they're running into problems after problems after problems.
All right, we're going to talk more about airline greed when we come back in a second, and also the cost of updating these systems. What would it cost versus the money they lose when things go awry because of old, outdated, antique technology? We're talking to Seth Kaplan from Airline Weekly and Charles Leoka from Travelers United on Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about airlines and computer problems, which American Airlines' wholly owned subsidiary PSA has been having since last Thursday, although they seem to have ironed it out the ripple effects of that go on a little bit. It will take a while to recover from that. Seth Kaplan is managing partner of Airline Weekly. He joins us from Washington on Skype. And Charlie Leoka, president of Travelers United, joins us from Roslyn, Virginia, overlooking the Key Bridge into Georgetown, also on Skype. This technology system, this cobbling together of legacy systems and newer technology and all with airlines around the world has been described as a hairball. Given the fact that the airlines, after many years of being unprofitable, are now profitable, if you're losing hundreds of millions of dollars when these technology glitches occur, how much money would it cost to dump all of your old technology and simply replace it, Seth?
Well, they've done some of that. You know, again, it's always, you know, it's almost like the chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And it often involves, something connected to something old, which the airlines always have to have because they're, you know, trading passengers with other airlines and those sorts of things. Look, to some degree, they have reinvested. I mean, if you take an airline, look, the most profitable airline in the world right now is Delta, just by kind of total, you know, billions of dollars that they earn. And they also happen to be the most reliable giant airline. They are on a everyday basis, just, you know, completing more flights, you know, there's some crazy number of days of the year that they don't cancel a single flight anywhere in the world. So they would say, look, we've taken a lot of that money and we've given it back to our shareholders, some of it. And we've given our employees raises, but we have invested in technology and that's why the airline's more reliable. So to some degree, it's worked now that these airlines are no longer struggling, as you said, to kind of get through the day as they were a decade ago when they legitimately just didn't have the money. But on the other hand, here we are, American Airlines, a perfectly, if not as profitable as Delta, certainly a perfectly profitable airline, going through what we've seen here in the past year. But I think the answer is that, even with all the money in the world, you'd still, because of things outside the control of that individual airline, you'd still have some legacy systems in place.
Yeah, and I think it should be pointed out that unlike banks, even though banks operate worldwide and have privacy and security concerns, airlines have even greater security concerns that they have to deal with. So they just can't outsource all this to some nebulous cloud or small company that does it. They have to go through security checks and all kinds of things to make this happen. We heard at the very beginning of the program, Charlie, these comments from passengers who were stranded over the weekend because of the outage with PSA at Charlotte Douglas Airport. And that leads us to, they could have been talking about a lot of different things with regard to air travel. Airline passengers in America have witnessed the decline in the number of carriers. We've seen them try to cram more seats on planes by lessening legroom. We've had to endure them taking away amenities like food and drink or charging for things that used to be free. We've had our carry-on bags limited. They charge now to check bags. Onboard restaurants, restrooms on some planes have become so small that it's become difficult to use them for some people. I don't believe that this is the case on a lot of international carriers from other countries. Why do U.S. passengers have to put up with all of this?
Well, a lot of the reasons is that, you know, we've come to a situation where the regulations of customer service on airlines is basically non-existent. There are only three areas where consumers will actually get something from the airline if the airline doesn't give the service that they're supposed to do. First, if you're bumped off of a flight, you will get compensation, and that's based on a formula, but it gets up to $1,350. Mm-hmm. If they lose or they delay or they destroy your luggage, you can get up to $3,500 domestically, less internationally. And then the other area would be if you're traveling internationally, you can get compensation based under the Montreal Convention. So other than that, the airlines have no liability except for their quote-unquote customer service image, let's say. And there must be consequences for the airlines if they are going to change this. They tell us all the time that they have the $200 change fee, and it's to take care of their lost opportunity cost, which I don't really understand when their lost opportunity might be 6 months before the actual flight. And there's really nothing lost, and they're still flying at near capacity. Mm-hmm. And we talk about ripple effect. The ripple effect is on the airlines, but there's a bigger ripple effect on consumers. And so I think that part of our problem is that when we discuss this, we discuss it from the industry point of view instead of from the consumer point of view. And those people that you heard from at the beginning of your program, they're talking about it from their passenger or consumer point of view, and they aren't happy.
Mike, the one thing I would say is that in terms of airlines here compared to around the world, look, compared to decades ago, right, we're never again going to get a free hot bad meal on an economy on a short haul flight. You know, we're always going to pay for checked bags on most airlines. Those things are here to stay. On the other hand, the European airlines, you know, British Airways passengers are complaining now about them now taking away things that the U.S. airlines took away a decade ago. It's become rather Spartan, especially on short haul flights. And the U.S. airlines, you know, I'm not sure that it's entirely sort of an inexorable race to the bottom, in the sense that they actually, now that they're not struggling anymore, have the luxury to, in some cases, give back some of what they've taken away. If you think about it, Delta, American, and United, a decade ago, they all took away free drinks, even on international flights, you know, alcoholic beverages, you know, free in-flight entertainment. They took off the snacks away, you know, even the pretzels and everything on short-haul flights. And at least two of the three of those, in all of those cases, those things that I mentioned, you know, they're going to pour you a glass of wine again in economy on a flight to Europe, let's say. So what's interesting is that, again, they're not going to give it all back. But they do have the luxury of saying, you know, if this little thing makes people happy, whereas back in the bankruptcy day, if they couldn't show how that spending that dollar was going to make them back a dollar that minute, they just couldn't do it. Now they can. So it's I think a little bit more complicated than simply that they keep taking away, although there's no question they're not going to give back a lot of what they've taken away.
And right. and to be fair to the airlines, they spent about 1.5, if I'm right about this, it sounds like an enormous amount of money, but they spent about $1.5 billion a month on technology personnel. So it's not like they're just ignoring their technology side, but are these glitches, like the one we experienced or passengers experienced this past weekend, Are they here to stay, pretty much? Are they going to be intermittent, but are they here to stay?
I think so. I think, you know, hopefully, again, when you average it all out across the year, hopefully this improvement continues. We're just on an average day, you're more likely to get there on time, which is the case. But they're just all so weird when they happen, and I don't know that these airlines are going to figure out how to prevent the weird thing that they can't imagine.
Charlie?
Right. And the other thing is that, yes, we're going to always have IT failures. There's always going to be storms. There's going to be a hurricane sweeping through your area. So there will be problems. But the airlines need to start putting their passengers first. Right now, let's assume that you can't get out on an American Airlines flight. It used to be that they'd put you on a Delta flight or a United flight. Not anymore. Delta and American are fighting with each other. They don't even take each other's passengers when there is some sort of a scheduling problem.
Actually, they actually did. That's right. They actually do now have the interline up again, Delta and American. But they, okay. What you're saying is correct. That this happened, yeah, a year ago.
It's the Microsoft Google wars of airlines. Seth Kaplan is managing partner of Airline Weekly. Charlie Leoka is president of Travelers United. Thanks for being here this morning and explaining all this to us. I'm not sure it helped, but it seemed to in the moment. Thanks very much.
Okay, take care.
We are now, believe it or not, 21 days into the 2018 hurricane season. It's the first day of summer. That season runs to December 1st. Last year was among the most destructive seasons on record, and already this year, the first named storm, Alberto, killed 5 people in North Carolina, triggered mudslides in the mountains, left an estimated $50 million in damage in that region. This, as people down east are still trying to repair the damage from Hurricane Matthew back in 2016. So what does the rest of this year and this hurricane season hold? For answers, we welcome back Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist at NBC Charlotte, and the American Meteorological Society's Broadcast Meteorologist of the Year, the nation's top broadcast meteorologist. Congratulations.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say that.
Wow.
Yeah, that was an amazing award. That was one of those things you don't really apply for or anything, and you know, your colleagues just nominate you, and you just find out. And it's amazing because I was an AMS member since I was like in the eighth grade, so that was a huge honor to me.
Well, congratulations. Brad is in our Spirit Square studio with us by phone. It's Dr. Gavin Smith, director of the University of North Carolina's Coastal Resilience Center. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell me what the Coastal Resilience Center is and what it does.
Sure. It is a center that was born out of Hurricane Katrina. The Department of Homeland Security provided funds to set up a center we competed for and won. It's a consortium of 27 universities around the U.S. that is focused on research, practice, and education, working to make coastal communities and states more resilient to the threats of coastal storms and climate change.
So both of you are here to talk about hurricanes and the upcoming the hurricane season that we're in right now. Forecasting the weather, as anybody will tell you, and certainly meteorologists will tell you, that forecasting the weather is an uncertain science, particularly when you get beyond 5 or 7 or even 10 days out. Last year was forecast to be an extremely active hurricane season that turned out to be correct. Hurricane season lasts 6 months. We're going to talk about predictions of what this kind of season may be, but how accurate can these predictions be? If you can't forecast whether it's going to rain next week this time, how can you forecast what kind of hurricane season it's going to be?
Well, I think the thing about the hurricane season forecast, you got to remember, it's strictly based on the number of storms in the entire Atlantic basin. So the forecast itself is actually kind of very smoothed out and rounded out. Because you're not really worried about how strong these hurricanes are going to be or where they're going to go. When you're issuing a seasonal forecast, it's strictly, is it going to be above average, below average, and we have a range. And believe it or not, these hurricane season forecasts have been, just like the regular forecasts, have been increasingly more accurate over time.
And why is that?
Well, we have a better understanding of the ingredients that go into the seasonal forecast. And the data we're getting is much better. We have much better sea surface data. We have much better upper air data. And we have great satellite information now that really allows us to put together a really good forecast, and just learning from the past. I always tell people when you become a meteorologist, the goal isn't always to be 100% right. You're trying to narrow the error as much as possible. And the way you become better is by kind of blowing a forecast. It sounds, horrible, but the thing about a blown forecast is you got to learn from it. So over time, we've become better because we've learned from past mistakes and past hurricane seasons. So we've really kind of fine-tuned this. But the one thing I don't like about the hurricane season forecast is just that. It's about the whole Atlantic basin. This doesn't really specifically talk about where a storm goes, because as we know, it only takes one storm hitting your community to make it a bad season.
And it's not just about the Atlantic Ocean, these hurricanes.
No.
The hurricanes in the Atlantic, hurricanes in the Pacific, or they call them typhoons in the Pacific, I think, are affected by worldwide weather conditions, wind temperatures, water temperatures, etc., correct?
Absolutely. We look at things in India, the monsoon season over there. We look at what's going on in sub-Saharan Africa. You look at a lot of these big oceanic circulations, not only in the Pacific, but also the Atlantic. One of the things that influences hurricane season in the Atlantic, it's what happens over in the Pacific with the El Nino, La Nina phase. So just think about that. A whole other ocean is having an influence on the weather in the other ocean.
Does the Atlantic Ocean and things happening in the Atlantic affect the Pacific? Because the Pacific certainly affects the Atlantic.
Absolutely. It does. It works both ways, because a lot of the waves, the tropical waves that form in the Pacific, actually usually originate down in Central America or in the northern part of Southern America, South America. So we tend to see what happens in the Atlantic influence what moves into the Pacific, and then vice versa. We look at what's going on in Africa quite a bit to see what's going to happen in the Atlantic Ocean.
So last year was the most destructive hurricane season, I think. Was it on record?
Yes, just because we had three massive storms that directly hit the U.S.
So what were the factors that made it so?
Well, last year we had really above average sea surface temperatures, not only in the Atlantic, what we call the main developmental region, which is kind of in that central Atlantic area, but also in the Gulf of Mexico. And then the fact that we had so much energy in the ocean, we also had the atmosphere coupled with that. And that's the one thing to remember. Sometimes we get caught up in the ocean temperatures, which are the fuel for these hurricanes. But if the atmosphere above them isn't conducive, it's like having a V8 engine with no fuel to go into it. In this case, last year, we had the engine and the fuel work together and make these massive Category 5 hurricanes.
I don't know whether it was predicted to be the most destructive, but it was certainly predicted to be an active season. So when the predictions like that come out, Dr. Smith, does your organization, the UNC's Coastal Resilience Center, spring into action or warn communities or start making plans on how to deal with a more active hurricane season, even though you have no idea if or where landfall will occur?
Well, just maybe perhaps a couple of points. Just I would echo my colleague in the sense of the idea of trying to predict a particular number of storms and what have you is a challenge. But I think an important element for the listeners is to recognize and think about the connection between natural hazard and disaster. Mm-hmm. In many ways, we've been talking about natural hazards, those physical characteristics of an event, and where they intersect with human settlements, which is what leads to disaster in essence. Disaster is really a human construct in the sense that the reason that the storms were so destructive is a combination of their intensity, the amounts of rainfall, and so forth, but it was also where they intersected. For example, when Maria intersected with Puerto Rico, an aging infrastructure, limited capacity to deal with recovery, they faced economic difficulty prior to the storm, which makes them more vulnerable and more susceptible to damages. Similarly, in the Houston area, which is where I grew up, not only was there unprecedented amounts of rainfall, but couple that with large-scale sprawling development in areas that were once wetlands and or rice fields, that combination can certainly lead to disaster. But to answer your question more directly, this is something we are working, 365 days a year on issues regardless of the season. Of course, we tend to have more explicit interactions during a storm because, for example, one of the things that our center does is we have developed and are continuing to improve upon storm surge models. And so we are developing methods and improving those methods to predict the impact of coastal storm surge prior to landfalling hurricanes and using that as a mechanism to try to inform communities' actions. For example, we also work with groups like the Coast Guard, and we were able to use storm surge models to predict expected storm surge inundation. And several years ago, the Coast Guard decided to temporarily relocate their assets, recognizing that the prediction showed that they would be inundated.
Dr. Gavin Smith, director of the UNC Coastal Resilience Center. We're going to come back and talk more about the impact of population and development and on climate change on all of this in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the hurricane season ahead, which is actually 21 days underway, with Brad Panovich, the nation's best television meteorologist. He's with NBC Charlotte, WCNC-TV. Dr. Gavin Smith joins us by phone, where he's the director of UNC's Coastal Resilience Center. Our coastline was spared for years from any major hurricanes, and the result of that was increasing confidence that we're immune to these things. They don't come here anymore. And developers down at the beach, for many reasons, just kept building. And as Dr. Smith mentioned, not just along the beach, but up into the marshlands, which serve as kind of a draining system for and a place for water to go when storm surge comes in. So if we start getting average hurricane season, and this is supposed to be average to above average, and last year was the most destructive one ever, what will that mean to these areas that have developed beyond belief?
It's amazing to think about how much development still goes on near the coast, knowing how susceptible they are to storm surge and these storms. I mean, you've got several things going on. You've got this rapid development along the coast. You have subsidence of the soil, and then you have climate change, which is leading to increasing sea level rise. So even in a non-storm setup, we're seeing higher than average tides. You talk to people in Miami, Florida, for instance, who, a king tide now floods downtown all the time. It happens in Charleston. There's just more stuff to break at the coast. So when we start seeing these destructive hurricanes, and like last year, we talk about, the number as far as the dollar amounts, a lot of that really was because of the amount of development and where these storms hit. So at some point, we got to decide, it's kind of like what we did here in Charlotte with the floodplains, where we started buying up some of these homes and apartment buildings that were in floodplains because we got tired of paying to rebuild them. I see in some parts of the country, especially along the coast, we might get to that point where we might have to say we're going to buy this land and no one's going to build here because it's just too susceptible.
One of the things that you do at the Coastal Resilience Center, Dr. Smith, is helping people get prepared. So given the damage that they're still trying to recover from on the coast from 2016's Hurricane Matthew, are coastal areas prepared?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's a complex question. You know, one interesting caveat, perhaps, is with Matthew, and this is one of the important lessons as well, is that, of course, hurricanes have different impacts. And in the case of Hurricane Matthew, it was a particularly devastating flood event. And so while the coast was large, it was less impacted. The inland riverine communities, many of them were devastated. And so that has been our focus. We were asked by the director of North Carolina Emergency Management and the governor to assist six small, particularly hard-hit communities recover, Windsor, Princeville, Kinston, Seven Springs, Lumberton, and Fairbluff. And we're continuing to work with them. But, you know, this is another challenge, is that hurricanes, we often think of them as very much coastal events, but when they turn inland and they drop large amounts of rain in these flood-prone areas, can certainly lead to major problems and significant disaster.
So I don't know which one of you can answer this question, but last year was the most destructive hurricane season on record. What role did climate change play in making that happen?
Well, it's a tough one because I think a lot of the numbers as far as dollar amounts really had to do with where they hit. But clearly, climate change plays a role. It's not the only role. I think there was a post-assessment on Hurricane Harvey, for instance, where they try to look back at the data to see how much could be attributed to climate change. And Hurricane Harvey was a unique storm because of its stalling out, which definitely led to a lot of the flooding. But, you know, there's a good estimation that, you know, the rain could have been, you know, 10 to 20% more because of climate change and the probability of a reoccurrence.
Well, the reason it stalled out and the reason more flooding seems to be occurring, you're the meteorologist here, but it seems to me that climate change is actually slowing down the steering currents.
Twofold things that climate change can do. It can slow down the steering currents, but one of the main things it does,
which means storms don't move.
Yeah, they move much slower, especially as they get closer to the coast. But one of the things that's unique about what's happened in the last couple of years is these heavy rain events, like we saw with Matthew, for instance, or Joaquin down in, which never really hit the U.S., but there was massive flooding in the Midlands of South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Both of those events, and even Harvey, had these unprecedented amounts of what we call precipitable water in the atmosphere. It's the amount of moisture in the column from the ground up to the top of the troposphere. And I'll be honest with you, in my career, some of these numbers we're seeing now are just unprecedented. 2, 3, 3.25 inches of precipitable water, which is sky high. We call these things atmospheric rivers, and you hear a lot about this on the West Coast now, but we're seeing a lot of these atmospheric river events where these tropical systems are now tapping into moisture way down in the tropics and moving it into inland areas, causing this massive amount of flooding. So, you know, as the world warms, it's going to hold more moisture. Right. And so when these storms develop, it's not that the climate change is causing the storms to develop. It's making them more severe.
But the fuel for hurricanes, if I'm not incorrect, is the ocean temperature, the temperature of the water of the ocean. As Antarctica continues to melt, and it is now melting. And the ice sheet in the Arctic is almost completely gone in the summertime. But Antarctica, which is based on land, and some of these ice sheets that are not part of the land are beginning to melt. As glaciers melt and they dump more and more colder water or take the temperature of the water down because they're ice, it's ice, and it begins to spread, won't that cause fewer hurricanes?
Well, what's interesting about hurricanes and what that does, first of all, that raises sea level. When you're melting fresh water and dumping into the ocean, you're raising the sea level. But what's interesting about that melting water, sometimes it disrupts the currents, the ocean currents, which have a huge influence on our weather and especially hurricane season. But there's kind of this dichotomy with hurricane season and climate change. We know, yes, the oceans are getting higher and they're getting warmer, which would mean more fuel for storms. But in some cases, climate change doesn't let the atmosphere kind of cooperate. There tends to be more wind shear and higher pressures because of a warming climate over the Atlantic, which sometimes can deter hurricane. So what we're seeing is the number of hurricanes.
The wind shear will come in and cut the top off.
Exactly. And that's kind of what we're starting to see a little bit out there here in mid-June. So what we're seeing is here we have all this fuel because of the of a warming climate, but we don't have the atmosphere working with it. So we tend to think we might get less storms, but the storms that do develop are going to have this high-octane fuel to feed off of, and they will be more intense.
So the Washington Post says that the water in the tropical Atlantic is the coldest in decades. Is that, Doctor, because of ice melt?
Well, so I guess... I would refer to other experts perhaps on that. I guess one thing I would allude to, and going back to kind of the hazards disasters relationship, is one of the grand challenges and the ability to try to plan for this and plan for deep uncertainty. This is going to be one of the great challenges of the 21st century in general, including how do we plan for and assess risk. And one of the challenges, and this was alluded to in earlier conversation, is how do we plan for, historically, we've tried to predict the future by looking into the past. And in an era of climate change, there is uncertainty in whether we can look to the past to predict the future. You know, this notion of stationarity, looking into the past to predict the future, there are arguments that that is going to be difficult to do. And so one of the grand challenges is going to be how do we map and assess risk looking into the future and use that data to inform very generally where and how people build in relation to these threats, and I'm referring to in particular flood hazard.
Well, how indeed? I mean, if the climate is changing, that doesn't mean it's going from point A to point B. It's cycling through a bunch of different areas, right?
That's right. And so there are methods to do that. And so the idea of planning for uncertainty is actually a growing field. And in fact, it's an interesting comment referring back to Charlotte, and this is a great example of it. Charlotte has been very proactive in not only moving people out of harm's way, but they've also mapped their floodplains looking into the future. When there is build out of their floodplains, their flood elevations will rise and spread within the floodplain. Well, they map and regulate today as if it's already happened. And that's a great example of forward thinking work, and that is one of the few places in the U.S. that's doing it. And I would predict in the future that that will be the future. We are going to have to plan for this uncertainty and regulate today in a way, thinking about how and where we build in relation to a threat that will become worse over time.
Well, the government, the federal government, helps people in these situations, and insurance companies pay a lot of money in these disasters areas. How long is that going to be allowed to continue? It's not profitable if you have to pay off every year and rebuild homes along the coast every year or build seawalls because the areas closest to the coast are flooding. At what point do you reach the breaking point on all of that?
Well, that's right. That's a great point. And in fact, the flood insurance program in the U.S. is provided by the federal government, and there's a reason for that. The genesis of the program, they were trying to create flood insurance rates that were relatively low to incentivize people to purchase flood insurance, thereby spreading the risk, if you will, in high-hazard areas and areas less prone to flooding. The problem is that we've set insurance rates that aren't actuarially sound, and therefore we're providing, in many ways, a perverse incentive to build in flood-prone areas. And efforts to make the flood insurance program more actuarially sound or solvent, there was significant pushback, for example, after Superstorm Sandy and others from New York, New Jersey, Florida, Texas, and others have pushed back to say we shouldn't do that. And so we're in a bit of a stalling pattern. We're moving towards charging those rates. However, one of the challenges will be is the rates could change dramatically, especially on the coast. And that seems to make sense. However, there's an equity issue. Those, the fishers, the crabbers, the people that work in the tourist industry, it will be unaffordable to live in some of these areas. And that's a philosophical, ethical question that a lot of us are trying to grapple with.
So when we talk about the cooling of the oceans, which is happening because of, I think, ice melt, we're talking about temperatures that are 0.01 degrees Celsius difference. I'm not a big Celsius guy. I know that's a bigger swing than you would see on the than it sounds like, because the Fahrenheit scale is much more accurate to me.
Yeah, it's one of the few metric scales that I would prefer we would stay with the Americans.
So how much is that Fahrenheit for those of us who are only Fahrenheit people?
Oh, you're still less than 1 degree.
Okay, so how can that make a major difference?
Well, you brought up the good point about the cooling in the Atlantic, and what's going on this year compared to last year is pretty dramatic. It's almost a 3 degree difference from last year to this year because it was so warm in the Atlantic. And a lot of what's going on in the Atlantic is the trade winds have changed a little bit this year. And this is how the atmosphere and ocean work together. Last year, we had a big area of low pressure in the Atlantic, and that counterclockwise spin was forcing warm water from the Caribbean out into the central Atlantic, thus making the water warm. This year, it's the opposite. We have a high pressure system, which is clockwise flow. It's pushing cooler water
from the north.
Yes. So it's causing this cooling out there. So that just goes to show you a small change in the pressures in the atmosphere above the ocean actually have a pretty big impact on the ocean. Now, to bring up your point about, you know, it's these small numbers, that's an average. In some spots, you know, it's much, much more dramatic than that. So when you average it out, it seems very minute. But when you look at the main development region, which is that central Atlantic, the change is much more dramatic.
So climate scientists have said if this remains the case, if the water stays cooler than normal, that this may stymie hurricane season a little bit. But I think it's you who said that this could cause more homegrown storms.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Okay, so homegrown storms, and typically are storms that develop very close to the United States. We're talking the Gulf of Mexico, off the southeast coast, the northern Caribbean area. When we get into what's called the Cape Verde season, which is late, the peak of hurricane season, if we think about Hugo, it started way off the coast of Africa, right, and tracked all the way across the Atlantic. We're probably less likely to see those type of storms. We're more likely to see a little disturbance in the Gulf of Mexico or off the coast of Florida, a cluster of thunderstorms develop into something and then move inland. So when I talk about homegrown systems, it's a stalled front. It's an old thunderstorm complex that moves over the warm waters in the coast, forms a tropical system, and then moves back inland. So in this type of season, we may see more of those closer to home than ones developing way out in the Atlantic. And the problem with that is, obviously, you don't have as much time. If you have a storm that's 7 to 10 days out, and it's moving across the Atlantic, you have days and days to watch it. In these homegrown systems, we might have just a handful of days.
We've talked about steering currents being slower, and that's why storms seem to be moving more sluggishly and dumping more rain, because they just sit there and it rains and it rains and it rains. And I've read that tropical cyclones, of which hurricanes are a part, have grown more sluggish. What's the difference between a tropical cyclone and a hurricane?
There is none. Tropical cyclone is like the technical term.
Because I've heard you on the air talk about cyclones. I'm telling, is that something new I missed?
all tropical cyclones are storm systems that form over warm water. So whether it's a hurricane, a typhoon, or a cyclone, meteorologically we call them tropical cyclones. So even in our office and among meteorologists, we'll refer to as a hurricane as a tropical cyclone. It's just that in the Atlantic basin and in the eastern Pacific, they're called hurricanes. When you get in the western Pacific, they're called typhoons. And in the Indian Ocean and the southern Pacific, they're called cyclones. But they're all tropical cyclones.
So you, Dr. Smith, wrote the book on planning for post-disaster recovery, reviewing the country's disaster assistance infrastructure. You lead the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Coastal Resilience Center of Excellence. Given that in Puerto Rico, the recovery is taking an enormous amount of time, that residents of North Carolina are still coping with Hurricane Matthew's damage 2 years ago, and that many of the top positions in FEMA are still unfilled a year and a half into the Trump administration, are we prepared?
Well, I guess that's the million or billion dollar question. There are parts. If you think about this, the complexities of this challenge, it really goes to the notion of governance, you know, the idea that federal, state, local, nonprofits, corporations, foundations, even groups that emerge after disaster. My point, all of these groups play a role, and sometimes I think we allude to just the federal government thinking about their capacity. And so one caveat is I think we need to think about the whole, all of those players.
I got 20 seconds.
That, That said, I think that given the complexities of increasing storms, there's a lot of work that we still need to do.
Okay. We have until December 1st to figure all this out. Dr. Gavin Smith, director of UNC's Coastal Resilience Center, Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist at NBC Charlotte, and the American Meteorological Society's Broadcast Meteorologist of the Year. Number one guy right here in our studio. Who knew? Thanks for being with us, both of you.